Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. The Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. And first, we are going to move up the House Bill 696. So if Representative Baker and his testifiers can make their way to the testifying table, that would be appreciated. While that's happening, Representative Crecia moves approval of the minutes from Thursday, February 9th. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes from Thursday, February 9th are adopted. And now, Representative Baker will move that House Bill 696 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services. Representative Baker, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We are going to start talking a lot about our great friends in all of Minnesota that are taking care of some folks in group homes with adults with disabilities, the waiver programs. And what my bill does is do a lot of the policy language that's going to help make it a little bit easier for them to take care of these folks, to provide what we're going to be calling good neighbors and other good reform in this policy thing. So, Mr. Chair, if I could just turn this over to my testifier, she'll go through the bill with us. House File 696, and we'll proceed with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and Representative Baker, you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that.
All right, Representative Baker moves the A1 amendment to get the bill into the form that he wishes. Representative Baker to the amendment.
What the amendment does, I believe it allows the five-room day extension, correct?
Correct.
Yes. So on the second page, currently homes could extend, or not extend, but add another fifth bedroom if they would. We don't get a lot of call for that, but we're wanting to extend that for two more years, Mr. Chair, for that amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Turner. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Barb Turner. I'm with ARM, the Vice President of External Affairs. And our policy, our bill looks more intimidating than it is because it's a lot of technical language. There's a lot of pages, but I'll try to go through it fairly quickly. I want to just speak to the amendment first so I don't forget. Just to clarify, currently there is the ability for a provider to request a variance to do a fifth bed in a group home. All of the requirements that have been in place remain in place, and the primary one is that the individuals living in the home have to agree that they would like to live with another person, with a fifth person, and so that's kind of the catalyst as to whether or not that can even happen, is people agreeing that that's okay with them. And so we don't change any of that language. We simply extend the ability to add that fifth bed for another 2 years. It isn't something that has had a lot of pickup recently, but we think we need to have it as a tool in our toolbox for a couple reasons. One, in this time of very critical staffing crisis, there are some providers, especially smaller providers, who need to start making some decisions about how they continue to operate, and the ability to do a fifth bed program is one of those ways. And the other primary use is when we're trying to develop situations where people are moving out of group homes into more independent settings. We end up with, you know, with what we're formulating still in the group homes that we have. So trying to have some space for people who may be doing some of those transitions is another use. And so that's why we would like to have that piece in. I'll go line by line through the bill. Starting the first section is
Ms. Turner.
Sure.
There is a question as to the A1 amendment. Sure. Representative Wiggling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Turner, I'm just looking at the language of the A1 amendment now, and I'm not seeing that this is about adding a fifth bed. What I'm seeing is, I don't know if maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing, but lines 3.4 to 3.6 of the amendment, and it looks like what you're doing here is just extending the sunsetting of the new adult foster care licenses.
It's the sunsetting of the fifth bed licenses, so a license for a fifth bed.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's not what it says. I mean, I guess maybe there's, Commissioner shall not issue a new adult foster care license under paragraph F. Okay, so is it paragraph F that's the issue is the fifth bed? Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it refers there. Okay, thank you.
Answer the question. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Ms. Turner.
Sure. So starting at line 2.7 and throughout that first section, there's language that simply puts in the statute what is now current practice in regards to child foster care background studies. So prior to this, there's some higher standards for child background studies due to a federal Adam Walsh Act. And prior to this, all those studies were being handled through the counties. And so, because of all the labor involved in processing these child foster care background studies, they were taking sometimes up to 6 months for clearance, which is obviously makes a problem for people who are looking for a job. They usually aren't sticking around 6 months waiting for a background clearance. DHS has worked out with the counties a process so that now all corporate foster care background studies are done through the Net Study 2.0 system, and the true family foster care, child foster care, continue to be done through the county. So that's a practice that's already in place, and this statute simply puts that into statute so it's clear that that's how those are being handled. So for providers of corporate services, it makes for a much more expedient background study process. Do you want me to stop between sections or just keep going?
Just keep going.
Okay. So on line 7.4, we add a new definition. This is under 245D. We add a new definition for natural support. And our reason for doing this is we have a lot of situations where people are wanting to take someone to a ball game or provide some kind of activity with somebody. And there's a lot of grayness between whether or not that's an actual volunteer, which if it is a volunteer, there are specific requirements in regards to background studies and training and various things, or whether it is in essence truly a natural support. And again, in this time of workforce crisis, we need to be able to utilize as many natural supports for people as we can, and we want to encourage those natural supports. And it's not very encouraging if you want to take someone to a ball game, but we have to say, oh, sorry, you need to go, sorry, neighbor, you need a background study before that can happen. So here we're trying to clarify what a natural support is, and then on line 7.11, we incorporate that into the definition of volunteer so that we try, again, clarify whether or not the provider has responsibility and oversight for someone who's actually a natural support to the individual, a friend or someone from the community. On line 8.29, we add a new service. So currently sitting at CMS is within our waiver amendments from Minnesota is a new service called Individualized Home Supports. It's another service to add to our spectrum of services, and we feel it's going to be a really good benefit to individuals who are looking to live in the community. And so in order to implement it, there are several places in statute that it needs to be added in order to utilize it, and so that's simply what this language is doing. So once it would be approved by CMS, it would then be in our statute that we could go ahead and use that service. Starting on line 10.21, we add several protection-related rights. And if you want me to go through them each specifically, but in that section there are several rights that have been added, and this is all so that we are in compliance with the CMS HCDS final rule, and they are incorporated into Minnesota's transition plan for compliance with that rule. On line 13.4, there's language being added that assures that people receiving services have control over their schedule. And again, that's to be in compliance with the HCDS final rule and our transition plan. Starting on line 13.11, we've added language here to require when someone is having a planning meeting, that there be a discussion about the use of technology or how technology might be used in meeting the needs of the individual. This language doesn't require anyone to actually use technology, but simply mandates that conversation happen. We feel that, again, due to our staffing crisis, we need to be creative in how we provide services to people, and there are a lot of really great technology opportunities that are already being used that could be used even in a more broad sense. residents, and so we want to spur those conversations in those planning meetings. And ARM has committed to having resources available, because it's hard to have a conversation if you don't know anything about what you're talking about. So ARM's committed to having some resources available so that teams would be able to access information in order to have some sort of discussion about the topic of technology. Line 13.21, there's revised language here that does two things in regards to orientation training specifically. One is it extends the orientation period from 60 days to 90 days. Again, in this time of crisis when we have high turnover in our positions, allowing a longer period of time to complete that orientation assures that we're not putting all of our training money up front. We have a longer period of time to make sure people are kind of getting acclimated and really are appropriate for the job that we've hired them for. And the second component of that eliminates the requirement of a minimum set of hours for training, but mandates that people be competent in all of the, there's a long list of topics that people have to have competency in, and so this would require people to be competent but would not have a minimum number of hours. Again, we're trying to use our resources as best as possible, and so there are some people that require 60 hours of training to be competent in all of those topics, and other people who are more seasoned who might only need 10 hours of training. And so we want to be able to put the dollars on training where they're needed, on the people who need more training in order to be competent, and not simply put hours in for the sake of putting hours in. So proof of competency is already a requirement, and providers have that mandate already, and so that's what this change would do. Then on line 14.3, this language would allow for the commissioner to approve online training and competency-based assessments that could be substituted for the current requirements for the annual training hour requirement for training under 245D. Again, it would be an option for a license holder that they could opt to do competency-based online training with an approved curriculum from the commissioner, or they could continue to operate under the current standard, which is a mandated set of hours and competency combined. On line 16.1, this section deals with the requirement for a basically a residency agreement between the recipient and the license holder when they're receiving residential services. Again, this is to bring us into compliance with the HCBS final rule and with Minnesota's transition plan. Line 16.1 requires that if a person's going to share a bedroom, they have to have the choice of the roommate in that situation. Again, this is brings us in compliance with the HCBS final rule and our transition plan. And so it's not, it doesn't require that they have choice of everyone who lives. If they're living in a four-bed program, if they're not sharing a bedroom, they don't have to have choice of everyone who lives in the home. But if they were to share a bedroom, whoever they share the bedroom with has to be a choice that they're able to make. On line 17.17, this requires that a person must be allowed to lock their bedroom door. Again, this is compliance with the HCBS final rule. And there is allowance if there's some reason that that's not appropriate for an individual, and it states that in their plan, there is an option for that to be documented and then that to be how it's dealt with. But the assumption is that people will have the ability to have a key and lock their bedroom door. And then on lines 18.35, 21.10, and 22.28, all of those lines have language that requires individuals to be given options on how to meet their needs that include services provided in non-disability-specific settings. Again, this is part of compliance with the HCBS final rule and our transition plan. And then the last section of language is our revisions under 256B. 24.3 clarifies that any services added, and this is our rate setting part of statute, and so the first 24.3 clarifies that any service added after January 1st, 2014 is not subject to the rate stabilization period. So this is important because we're adding a new service to the DWS rate setting, and it wouldn't have the same stabilization that services that had already been in place would have. 25.5 adds the new service that I mentioned earlier, individualized home supports, to the list of available services under the rate setting system. Line 26.21 establishes the codes to be used to determine the rate for that same new service. 29.21 adds the new service to the list of unit-based services. That would be a unit-based service. So, again, it's just another place within that DWS language that it needs to be added. And then the last new line, 31.23, clarifies that the new service is not subject to budget neutrality adjustments. So that's a brief, quick summary of what's contained in our policy bill.
Thank you, Ms. Turner, for that overview. Are there questions for the testifier? Seeing none at the moment. Representative Baker, do you have any more testifiers on the bill?
Mr. Chair, no, we don't.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 696? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wonder, I guess, you know, there's a lot here, and I'm no expert on this area, and I doubt that many of us around the table are. I'm just wondering whether DHS has a response to the bill, or, I mean, I assume that you've worked this out with DHS. I'm sorry if I missed that at the beginning.
Sure. So we have received some technical assistance from DHS on portions of the bill, and to my knowledge, they're not opposed to anything that is contained in the bill.
Okay. I wonder if we could have DHS come down and give
us. Certainly, Representative Liebling. If someone from the department would like to give comment on the bill. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. We, as Ms. Turner stated, we have provided a lot of technical assistance on this bill, and we do not have, there might be a couple wording suggestions, but we don't have any concerns with any sections of the bill.
Representative Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other questions from members? Final word, Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, there's over 9,000 people that were short in the home and community-based businesses out there. We need to provide some softer regulations, and I think this really does a nice job, and I appreciate the work of ARM, and that'll be all, Mr. Chair. We appreciate your support, and happy Valentine's Day.
All right. With that, Representative Baker renews his motion that House Bill 696, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House Bill 696, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Baker. Next up, we will move to House File 851 with Representative McDonald. And as he's making his way up front, Representative McDonald moves that House File 851 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative McDonald, whenever you're ready.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, Mr. Chairman, House File 851 establishes a competitive grant program for funding and organizations governed by people with intellectual and developmental disabilities that administers a statewide network of disability groups focused on the leadership, development, and self-advocacy of skills of Minnesotans with disabilities. Here in this very committee and in various settings across the state, there are important conversations taking place of how we as a state can support our friends with disabilities to live very meaningful lives in our communities based on their own choices about where, how they live, how they work, and how they play. These conversations are resulting in many innovative ideas on how we can move forward to share our own goals while using state dollars in the most efficient and effective way, including ideas that exist in reform existing programs, increasing choice for individuals around how they use limited support dollars, and more. However, a key to our success as a state in supporting Minnesota with disabilities is for individuals with disabilities themselves to advocate for their own vision of what they want their lives to be like, where they want to live, where they want to work, and what they want to do. This, whether the advocacy takes place within their own family, their own place, or work, or living, or school, or in their communities, or even here at the Capitol. The grant funds proposed in this bill would support specific activities focused on the development of these leadership and advocacy skills that Minnesota with disabilities. I know we are faced with some difficult decisions this year as we decide on what is important and how to best spend taxpayers' dollars, but I assure you that this bill will do exactly what I think this group in the Health and Human Services has done for many, many years, and that's help those with disabilities, to help those who have disabilities live in their own communities, to be able to work in their communities, to be a part of their families, to be a part of our community, and to live healthy, happy, and productive lives just like every one of us. So today I want to introduce my good friend Mary Kay. She will, Mary Kay Kennedy, she works for Advocacy Change Together, and she really is the boots on the ground, if you will, and there's many in the room here that I see that do that as well, that work with the disability community in Minnesota to make sure that their quality of lives is just as good as any one of us, that they can live, work, play in their communities, and be productive and happy and healthy. So she really is the champion of those with disabilities. So I'd like to turn it over to her. But before I do, Mr. Sherman, I do have an amendment. Should we move that now?
Representative McDonald moves the A1 amendment. Representative McDonald, to your amendment.
Thank you. What this amendment does is it changes the name Advocacy Change Together and inserts an organization governed by people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and administering a statewide network of disability groups. So what that does is it's just taking the name Advocacy Change Together, incorporating it so there's many groups and many organizations can take advantage of, hopefully, this bill and the funds to help those with disabilities. So that's what this particular amendment does.
All right. Questions from members for the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So with that, Mr. Chair, may I introduce Mary Kay Kennedy, and she'll give a little brief testimony of the bill as well.
Ms. Kennedy, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Mary Kay Kennedy, and I am the Executive Director of Advocating Change Together, Center for Disability Leadership. And I want to thank you, Chair, and members of the committee for this opportunity to testify on House File 851. Due in part to federal integration mandates, Minnesota is working to create new strategies that give folks with disabilities the same rights and freedoms as their non-disabled peers and build the capacity to lead these statewide changes. During this session, you will be hearing lots of new ideas about increasing choice and opportunity for people with disabilities. It's an exciting time for Minnesota as we're taking the burden off of people with disabilities to change themselves to fit society, and we're really, I think, as a state, really working hard to change society so that everybody gets to be included in community life. While we do understand that funding will be limited this session, we are compelled to make an argument for why funding is needed to support people with developmental disabilities to be part of the leadership as Minnesota makes service changes that affect them. As people in our community say, nothing about us without us. In the interest of time, I will briefly summarize what the grant funds would be used for. So as Representative McDonald summarized, basically the funds are to maintain and strengthen a network of groups of folks with developmental disabilities in six regions of the state, and the funds will develop leaders with disabilities to move Minnesota integration mandates forward. I will just share a few of the features of the program and invite you to review many more of the features in the written testimony. So again, it's to maintain the infrastructure and outreach for a statewide network for peer-led skill trainings across the state. And then through this network, build awareness of service options related to housing, employment, education, transportation, as well as emerging reform initiatives contained in our state's Olmstead Plan, Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, and new federal home and community-based service regulations. The funds will help us connect people with intellectual disabilities to people that can help help people with informed choice so that they really know what the choices they have before them if they choose to transition to different services. And I'll just read one final feature. The funds would allow statewide self-advocacy conferencing and disability networking. So that would be both small and fairly large groups. My organization has made a commitment to getting outside expertise to measure what is changing because of the work we do. We conduct environmental scans, create logic models, and for individual programs, we contract for program effectiveness assessments. We are happy to share any and all of this data with you upon request. But in a nutshell, the assessments really show that we are making a difference, and the methods that we use do yield measurable integration outcomes and leadership outcomes. In 2015, we conducted an environmental scan, and the scan showed that disability groups across the state, as well as government agencies like DHS, DD Council, DEED, Disability Law Center, seems like everybody clearly agrees that there is a need to support and grow the efforts to advance disability leadership and supported self-direction. The scan reveals that we've accomplished a great deal in the past decade, but we've also got a long way to go. So the biggest question is really not how to build leadership for integration, but the biggest question is how to finance it. And that's why we're here. So we're asking for public investment to continue and expand the work. Thank you very much for your consideration of this request.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kennedy, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Could you just speak a little bit to the testifier? Could you speak a little bit about to the six regions and some of the work in Greater Minnesota and what some of those organizations that you typically work with look like?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Ms. Kennedy.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. In 2006, our state developed a self-advocacy network called Self Advocates Minnesota. And we divided the state into six regions. And the Department of Human Services, the Developmental Disabilities Council, and then some private, like the Bremer Foundation and other sources, have given money with the intent to go out to the regions to work on the kind of thing that we're just talking about, self-empowerment of folks with intellectual disabilities. So those regions have contracts with Advocating Change Together, and they work on three areas. They work on personal empowerment to help people just kind of understand that they do have personal power. So that would be things like assertiveness trainings and that type of just knowing who you are and what you want. And then the second thing each of the regions work on is just understanding of disability and disability rights, and maybe some of the initiatives we're talking about here, what's happening in society. And then the third thing that each region works on is tangible ways to make community better for everybody. So just getting out there, doing work in the community, volunteering, being part of your church choir, just being a regular part of the community.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's great. I guess my question is even more just who on the ground, could you just speak to sort of the ground game of it, like how you're making sure the right people are in the room and hearing about it and how this connects in Greater Minnesota in that way?
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks, Kennedy.
So each of the regions chooses a host agency, which is many times an ARC chapter. And then that chapter actually is, the host agent for the activities. And then they hire a community organizer. And then that person goes out and connects with things that are already happening in the community and also helps to develop. So they would go to the schools and help the self-advocacy or the kids in schools kind of figure out how to do some of the work. And there are many like people first groups and other self-empowerment groups.
Representative Olson.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I think about the idea underneath this bill and the idea of self-advocacy, it seems to me what you're trying to achieve is greater independence for and greater autonomy for people with intellectual disabilities. And one of the barriers to that, I think as we look at news coverage and the experiences of people, is the system itself who seeks to look out for and advocate for people with intellectual disabilities people can do more than maybe we expect that they can do. So how, and I like the idea of self-empowerment, but how do we know as policymakers that the funding aimed at self-advocacy will really release the people and that the system, the bureaucracy, will respond to the skill level and the actual ability of the people you wish to serve, the people who are seeking self-empowerment, right? And it's a complicated question, but...
Well, it's a great question, and that's one of the reasons that we've noted that we really do try to bring in some outside expertise to help measure some of it. Because as many of us, you know, we all know we're probably implementing our methods well, but then are those methods really resulting in the outcomes that we want? So that is something that we pay attention to. And for many folks, it's really about building relationship over time. So I've given the example like of a woman that started to come to some of the ACT events. And when she came, her family was calling her names, derogatory, the R word name. It was a very oppressive family situation. And when she came to our community, she said, well, what can I really do about that? Because technically they're right. Technically they're right. I do have that disability. So, and it was over time that just by interacting with other people with disabilities and going through a process of just thinking about, wow, maybe I'm okay the way I am and maybe something else needs to change. And by the end, you know, after being with us for months over, you know, many gatherings, she really transformed how she sees herself. So now if she introduced herself, she'd say, I'm a disability rights person. And she's asked for a job at raise at her job. She met with she's met with civil rights leaders, and so she's really now sees herself as part of a community of people that have pride in who we are. So I think it's that type of thing. Sometimes it's hard to measure if you're measuring in a kind of a snapshot. It's over time that people really transform how they see themselves, and then really hold the system more accountable. So one of the other evaluations that I shared with Representative McDonald was that a lot of people coming into our trainings, they don't know anything about, you know, like how Barb Turner was saying all these rules about, oh, people, if you're going to add a fifth person to the house, there should be, you know, consent on that, and you have the right to lock your door, and you have, you know, there are all these rights that we talk about. But I tell you, the folks out there with developmental disabilities, they absolutely do not know those rights. So for us to be able to say, hey, there are some laws and some things that are here to protect you, and then helping them think together about, well, how can you assert your right to get more of what you want out of life.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate the intention and the explanation, and I just want you to keep pushing, push us and push Minnesotans.
Great. Well, thank you for your question.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair, and, you know, thank you for that. I, as I'm listening to you talking about this more and more, it gets, it's pretty exciting, actually. Mm-hmm. And the statement that you just made about people knowing their rights and feeling that they are empowered, you know, it just sort of struck me that it isn't only people with disabilities who need that. That oftentimes just people in everyday walks of life, you know, ordinary working people sometimes don't realize their own power. And, you know, as we struggle to help build a more inclusive society, and especially now that a lot of employers are telling us that they can't find people to work. And how do we really build a society not only that's inclusive, but where everybody really understands their own power and abilities? And we often talk in this committee about people working at the top of their licenses. How about we all work at the top of our abilities? I'm kind of excited by what you're talking about, and thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Ms. Kennedy, any response to that?
Well, just thank you. I mean, we absolutely agree with what you're saying, and I guess just in Just one other comment that I'd like just to make is that a lot of our work is about helping people shift their idea of who they are. So for many people, their entire life has been others trying to rehabilitate them, get them to lose weight. You have to change to fit society. So I think that the joy of what the work that we do is help people kind of shift that to think, well, I'm okay the way I am, and I have a lot to contribute. And people really do have a tremendous amount to contribute to society.
All right. Are there any other questions for Ms. Kennedy? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 851? All right, if you can make your way down to the testifying table and then please state your name and give us your testimony.
My name is Lynetta Mulhoser, and not planning on talking on this today, but because it's a point of interest, I have a son with a special disability, and one of the things is teaching them that they can succeed and do stuff, they just do it differently. Growing up, my son is 13 right now, and he used to always say, everybody says I'm stupid, and he's high-functioning autism. I'm stupid, Mom, I can't do this, and I have to tell him, no, you're not stupid. Well, how do you know? I said, am I stupid? No, Mom, you're very smart. I said, well, you're my son. There's no way you can be stupid. Mm-hmm. To this day, he has never called himself stupid again. So part of it is that part. And moving forward, sometimes they keep saying we should be in a least restrictive environment. These people, these children, these adults that are transitioning into the community need to have choices. My son has that choice. I've chosen to put him in a school that focuses on this. And he's like, I don't get bullied anymore, Mom. Because if I bully them, I'm bullying myself. Because he is learning from other people, he is now on a student council. He is on a quiz bowl. If he would have stayed with his peers where they put him down, he would never advance to that step. So he's learning to be a leader because he's being led by other peers that have similar disabilities. The other thing is if we don't help these people get to their highest potential, we're supporting them in the community financially and throughout the rest of their life. If we can help them achieve their highest level, we actually are allowing them to have a more productive life, and we're also allowing them to take on more responsibility for themselves. You know, we have that talk, and even at 14, well, can I afford an apartment, Mom, or do I have to have a roommate instead of, well, I'm going to live in a group home where somebody else is going to pay for everything for the rest of my life. It's what can I do to help do that? And so I may not hit that at 18, but I may hit that by 24. And he's going to have a better life, and he's going to be less dependent on the overall system if we can support that.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Dean.
Thank you, and thank you for sharing that. You know, a lot of times we hear from parents that struggle with mainstreaming and try to struggle between mainstreaming and right-streaming and advocating for your kid. And it sounds like along the way that you found a right path, or you got in touch with right people. Was that in spite of help or because of help, or
in
what's your perspective?
My son was diagnosed in first grade with high-functioning autism. And the elementary, we're up in the Anoka School District, Independent School District 11. The elementary schools did well. In the middle school, they start pulling back. But because he had had support to help him, he was advancing very good. And then all of a sudden in middle school, they pulled out all the support. And part of it is that education and learning how to interact with these kids. And so instead, they started treating him as if he was a bad child. And all of a sudden, you see other tics coming out. And when you have a kid who, you know, is experiencing sensory overload and nobody knows how to deal with it, and they're saying, he's doing this, you need to talk to him. And I'm like, no, this is part of his disability. You don't understand. And I fought and I argued and I tried to change schedules. And I got to a point where, honestly, I gave up. And luckily, I had on my own research, and it's hard for somebody who doesn't know how to access these. We need to get them out there. But they don't want you're so overwhelmed. I remember crying. I'm a nurse. And I remember crying and knowing, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get about through this and that. And I just happened to find out about this school called Lionsgate where, you know, they can do this. It's a smaller setting. All of the teachers there are trained in disabilities. And they accept the kids at where they're at. And they teach them that it's not about them being different. It's about how they can succeed at doing it. And the goal, even from the age of 12 on up, is how are you going to learn to be independent? How are you going to do this? What are your goals for the future? Do you want to go to college? You know, in the high school, they're like, well, they can't do this, and they start pulling them out of their mainstream classes. I went from being in reduced classes back into mainstream classes because it wasn't about what he couldn't do, but it was how do we support what he can do. And there's a wonderful group of programs. I just didn't know how to access them at the time, and I'm learning more as I go on. So it's how do we get that information to the parents? How do we get, even the kids when they were talking about having choices, they don't want to look different. Especially, it's almost harder for that mid-group that's at that higher functioning because they know they're different and they don't know how to correct that. And those are the group that we can make a huge difference. Sometimes there are some disabilities and they are happy and don't know where they're at with it. But when I see that group that's right there in the middle and they don't know, how do I access this? I know I want to do this. You know, I want to go. I don't tell him you can't go into the military because he's like, well, Mom, I maybe want to go in the military. And I think, well, you're going to resist everything they tell you to do. But I don't say that because it's like, well, if this is what you want to do, this is what you're going to have to accomplish in moving forward. And that's what we really need help with in the community and the resources to get there. And it is a struggle. Part of it, a lot of it's education. It's educating and getting that information out to people so they can build.
Thank you, Trudy.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier? All right, seeing none. Ms. Mulhauser, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against House File 851? Seeing none. Representative McDonald, final word.
Yeah, thank you. See, I just neglected to... you know, in my opening, I talked about the precious dollars and how they'll be allocated this session. And I didn't even mention what my bill costs. And I think that's not good governance on my part. So some of you on the committee already know the numbers. You see the fiscal note from the House research. But it's $143,000 for 2018 for one paragraph, another $105,000 for 2018 for a total of $248,000 for fiscal year 18 and 19 and then going forward. That's a lot of money, right? $248,000. It's a small little bucket compared to some of the bigger issues that we have. But I believe firmly that every dollar is spent very wisely in the self-advocacy groups in helping those who have developmental disabilities. I have a cousin, Tom Early, who lives in a group home in Delano, group residential housing, the Dells home, and now it's REM. But I tell you, when the community gets out, there's only five beds in that home, and then there's two homes in Delano. But when they go out into the community, when we see them at church and at the ball games and at the restaurants and at the city celebrations, I think it does more for us who don't have that disability than them. It lifts us up as we see them experience life as they should, to be treated with dignity and respect and treated fairly just as much as any one of us here. So it helps lift our humanity and makes us more compassionate and tender and understanding. And I carried this bill a couple of years ago and I'll continue to carry it as long as I'm here at the Capitol. I believe it's one of the best resources of our precious tax dollars. And I'm confident that everyone in Wright County that I represent is pleased, or they all tell them they should be pleased, that this good bill and their hard-earned money does great things far beyond anything that we can comprehend. So with that, I ask for your support on the bill, and we'll follow this along as it continues to travel down the road. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McDonald renews his motion that House File 851 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Thank you,
Member Sales. And House File 851 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance as amended. Next up, members, we have Representative Keel, who is moving at House File 921 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Keel, when you are ready, you have the floor.
Good morning, members, and thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is kind of a twofold bill. It has conversation about our changes in therapeutic leave days and also a waiver consolidation of home and community-based services. I know we have a full slate today, so I am going to ask my testifier to take over.
All right, Ms. Turner, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Barb Turner. I'm with ARM as the Vice President of External Affairs. And to briefly describe what this bill does, in the first section, there's some antiquated, what we believe is antiquated language in regards to payments of providers of ICF services. When ICFs were being established, there was language in, put in place that encouraged them to fill the beds of the programs they developed before they developed additional new ICFs. Development of ICFs is no longer allowed. There is no new development. And what they did back then was implemented a system where after 30 days of an open bed where you've had an open bed in your facility, if you still have that open bed, you can no longer bill for therapeutic leave days for the rest of the people who live in the program. So when people go to camp or go home for a visit, those days are days that are billable under the ICF system. But if you have an open bed in your facility, you can't bill for those days once you've exceeded 30 days of having an open bed. So that was put in place to encourage people to fill those beds. Well, now when people in with ICFs have open beds, it's not because they're not trying to fill the beds. It's because there's been no one appropriate to fill the bed or no one who is interested in the bed in the location. This is even more problematic the more rural you get in Minnesota because you have to find the right person who wants to live in that particular locality in order to get your bed ever filled. So with the way it's set up right now, these providers are actually being harmed twice. They have an open bed, so they're not receiving revenue for a bed to help run that facility. And then after 30 days in a calendar year of having that bed open, they also can no longer bill for people that they would have been able to bill for had that bed been filled. And so we're looking to change that so that people can continue to bill for therapeutic leave days even if they have an open bed in their facility. And the second part of this bill is something that, again, we've worked with the department on. They're looking at, we would like them to look at doing a study on consolidating the four disability waivers. So right now we have different services available depending on which waiver you're on, different things that apply depending on which waiver you're on, and we'd like to look at consolidating that. We feel that it would be a lot easier to manage both at the state level as well as the provider level if they were run the same and have the same opportunities for people. So right now, if you have a diagnosis of a developmental disability, there's a chance that you actually got put on the CADI waiver versus the DD waiver, and there are different services available under those two things. And so simply because of which waiver you were allocated, there are things you can or cannot obtain. And so we'd like to look at this study and get a report about what the pros and cons basically of looking at a consolidation of the waivers.
All right, Ms. Turner, thank you for your walkthrough of the bill there. Are there any questions for the testifier or for the bill author? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to clarify a little bit. So there are really two very different things going on in the bill, right?
There are, and we put these both in one bill because they were both money issues. Our other bill is totally policy, and so this was our ARM bill that had two money items in it. But they are unrelated, yes.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I think it's a really an interesting idea to study combining the waivers. I have to say, years ago when I first heard the term waiver, I was so confused even by that term. And, I'm sure the public, when you say CADI waiver and CAC waiver, it's like, what? So I think people who don't live in the world of disability don't understand what all those things are. And I think that wherever we can simplify, if it makes sense to do that, it would be beneficial. So I think it would be a really great idea to study it. So thank you for bringing that forward. You know, whether what that would mean, who knows, but to look at it would be a great thing. The other piece of it, you talked a little bit about providers and, you know, why they need the change, but can you talk about what that might mean for recipients of services? Would this mean that they notice the change at all, or would this make more services available, or, you know,
I think the primary thing that may impact people who receive services in an ICF is there would be less incentive for a provider to encourage more therapeutic visits if they know they're not going to be reimbursed for those days. So encouraging people to attend a camp or those sorts of things which they normally would be able to bill for if they didn't have an open bed, you know, there is the possibility that there'd be less encouragement of people taking those kind of days because if they're gone, the revenue's gone.
Representative Leibold.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're not saying that's happening, but it might be happening that if somebody has, if there's an open bed and they know then they're going to lose revenue, I think I'm just kind of paraphrasing what you just said, that they might actually not be encouraging people to take advantage of opportunities that are there for them, because then the provider would be losing revenue.
Yes. So I'm not saying it's happening, but I'm saying it is the potential,
okay,
and that could happen.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other questions for the testifier or the bill author? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 921? All right, seeing none. Representative Keel, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and please vote for the bill.
All right, with that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 921 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 921 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Keel. Next up, we'll have House File 873, and Representative Hamilton had a family issue to deal with this morning, was unable to make it, so one of the co-authors to the bill will be presenting this morning on his behalf. So Representative Baker will therefore make a motion that House File 873 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Baker, when you are ready, please tell us about the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm proud to stand in for Representative Hamilton, who is inability to be here today. But House File 873, folks, is the Best Life Alliance legislation that provides a consecutive 4% wage increases for more than 80,000 direct care workers statewide. We're looking for a 4% in both years 17 and 18. It also calls for the development of long-term solutions and funding for the health insurance for these direct care workers. This bill has strong bipartisan support in the House and the Senate. We've got some professionals here today that are going to talk about it. I'll turn it over to our testifiers, Mr. Chair, and take it from there.
All right. And before they begin, Representative Hamilton just sent us a note with his apologies. And since it was Valentine's Day, also sent us a bag of candy that will be sent around. And so we have that as well this morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pam Ganella, and I'm the chair of the Best Life Alliance. I'm here to ask you to support House File 873. We are currently facing an unprecedented workforce crisis in community-based services for people with disabilities all over Minnesota. The legislation before you today proposes better compensation for direct care workers. These direct care workers are critical for the quality of care in Minnesota for persons with disabilities, like my daughter, Sarah. Sarah was not born with a disability. When she was 5 years old, she suffered severe brain damage from a viral infection. She survived, but suddenly our wonderful girl could no longer speak. She must be fed, dressed, bathed, and diapered. She can still walk, but is partially blind and unable to protect herself from dangers as she walks around. with the help of, despite these disabilities, Sarah is a wonderfully happy girl. And I just don't know how this happened, but she is just a joy for us. I just wanted to show you, this is a picture of Sarah with her two brothers, Mark and Luke. And it's one of my favorite photographs because they're all so happy. And I just wanted to share that with you. When Sarah became disabled, our son Mark was 4 years old, and Luke was just 10 days old. I gave up a career as an attorney to care for Sarah at home for 25 years with the help of direct care workers that came to our house. 4 years ago, we moved Sarah to a group home where she lives there. It's an ICF. She lives there with five other persons with severe disabilities. At first, the staff there had three staff workers for each daytime shift for the six residents. Then staff turnover began to increase dramatically. Now, instead of three staff for a shift, there are only two. And this limits the supports that they can provide to Sarah and her other housemates. Two staff is also the minimum staff they can have and still meet their licensing requirements. I'm on the board of Living Well Disability Services, which is the nonprofit that operates and owns Sarah's group home. Currently, they have a staff turnover rate of 38%, and they have 84 unfilled direct care worker positions. This is similar to providers all around Minnesota, and some have even higher turnover rates. These turnover rates and job vacancies have an enormous effect on the continuation of community services for people with disabilities. Last summer, I attended the Department of Human Services Workforce Summit. While some long-term strategies for addressing the workforce crisis were discussed and will probably continue to be explored, the immediate step of increasing the wages of direct support professionals was the first strategy suggested by many people. Individuals with disabilities, they experience the effects of this workforce crisis every day. We as parents and family members, we go to visit the group homes. We see the crisis whenever we go and visit. Personally, I go to Sarah's group home, and when I pull up in the driveway, I look, and if there's two cars there, I know that there's only two people on staff at that time. And these five people have very significant disabilities and require a lot of care. We see these changes and we wonder what's going to happen if there's no longer staff to provide quality care for group homes, employment support programs, and other community-based settings. Will the health and safety of our children be at risk? Will parents who are trying to care for their child at home as we did not be able to do that? Will people trying to live independently in the community not be able to continue that because they can't find staff to help them? If this workforce crisis goes on unaddressed, what will that mean for our loved ones with disabilities and their ability to live and learn and work and play in the community with the rest of us? I always pray that Sarah will continue to be surrounded by people who love her and take good care of her. Please support this bill to stabilize these essential services for Sarah and all the other persons with disabilities in Minnesota that depend on them. Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Ganella, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for sharing your story this morning and your advocacy today. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Paula Hart, and I'm president and CEO of Volunteers of America in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you, and happy Valentine's Day. First, the good news. We have many long-term, very dedicated and compassionate direct support professionals in this field in Minnesota, people who have worked for decades, whose hearts are bigger than this room. I'm blown over every time I spend time with one of them. And they are also very skilled because the kind of work that Pam described is based not only on deep compassion but also on skills. However, as we've heard over and over again this morning, we are in the midst of a workforce crisis, and we're here today to ask for your support to help increase wages so that we can improve both the retention and the recruitment of these very needed direct support professionals. We have 8,700 openings in the state at Volunteers of America. 13% of our positions are open. We had a turnover last year of 48%. That's a lot of churn with people who come in and out the door. We have very high overtime as a result, and that's not necessarily overtime that people want to work. It's a very expensive way to provide services, and it's a high burnout potentially for those caring direct support providers. We have tried and continue to try many creative approaches, from new positions, job redesign, creative use of social media, workforce, word-of-mouth referrals, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, we are really asking for your support for higher wages so that we can provide the stability for people with disabilities that, as Pam said, are our friends and our neighbors and loved ones. So thank you for your time and for your support for this bill today.
Thank you, Ms. Hart, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Representative Baker, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not. I do have the Best Alliance friend, Kevin Goodnow. If anybody had any questions or technical questions for Mr. Goodnow, he is available for questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Otherwise, no.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against House File 873? All right, if you could make your way down, and when you get there, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Pam Selvig, and I'm actually the Health and Human Services Director with Scott County. Today I'm here at representing AMC, MACSA, the Minnesota County Association of Social Service Administrators, and MICA, the Minnesota Inter-County Association. As you know, our associations represent all Minnesota counties: urban, suburban, rural, union, large, and small. This bill is one that affects counties statewide. First of all, I want to offer my support for the rate increase contained in House File 873. We agree that home community-based service workers making $10 to $11 per hour do great work in the community and should get an increase in wages. We know the heart of this bill is about more than wages. It is about providing care to those most in need. We want individuals who need care to get appropriate services by trained and caring staff who are justly compensated. I am coming before you today, however, to ask for your consideration that counties be exempt from the mandatory wage increase for home and community-based service workers. The purpose of this bill is to increase wages for home community-based service workers making low hourly wages. We want workers to be paid well for their families and to be able to continue this important work. However, counties are not who this bill is targeting. The intent of the bill is to focus on direct care workers, not county case managers, but the language as introduced is unclear. Simple, clear, direct language would help avoid the kind of confusion that resulted from vague language in the rate increase measure passed in 2014. In that instance, DHS initially indicated that county employees would not be included in the mandatory wage increase, as had been the interpretation up until that point. Subsequently, county workers were included. County case managers make between $32,000 and $90,000 annually. In Scott County, our starting salary is $57,000 for case managers. These incomes come with benefits such as health care, pensions, and paid time off. These wages reflect union and non-union, rural and metro counties alike. They are livable wages. Counties remain committed to providing increases to all of their employees given the limits of their budgets. Many counties, even in times of budget deficit, have continued to increase wages even when the state has reduced funding. In Scott County, at our DT&H, county workers' starting salary is over $17 per hour. These county employees are already this year receiving a 5% increase with a 2.5% COLA and an additional 2.5% increase based on performance. If this bill is enacted as written, these workers who are already justly compensated and making at least $5 more per hour than the workers targeted by this bill will, in effect, be receiving a 9% pay increase per year for the next 2 years. We are concerned that under this legislation, DHS will again require counties to develop a distribution plan and obtain a letter of acceptance from the exclusive bargaining unit. For counties with union contracts, this requires that the county reopen collective bargaining agreements in the middle of a contract term. No collective bargaining agreements require reopening contracts for this type of situation. Counties are opposed to allowing unions to renegotiate previously settled items under the guise of implementing the wage increases, as this undermines the collective bargaining process. For counties that are not part of, collective bargaining and counties who are, this increase changes staff costs in the middle of a fiscal year. This is not only administratively difficult, but creates a precedent that the legislature may dictate the pay scale for local units of government, which to my knowledge has not been done previously. Counties care about the communities we serve and are supportive of increases to home and community-based services. County expenses far exceed what the state gives us for case management for all case management workers. Counties invest in these services as partners with the state in providing services to Minnesota's most vulnerable populations. We want our clients to have the greatest care possible. We recognize this bill helps to do that, but counties are concerned with the impact of the current language has on counties and respectfully ask for exemption from the mandatory wage increases. We remain committed to working with the authors so that the bill appropriately impacts the areas most in need. Thank you for your time and your careful consideration in this matter. We look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Solvig, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for the testifier? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate you bringing this to the attention of the committee. And I have probably a series of questions that we probably won't cover here, but I would like to know your perspective on if you get the exemption and the people who are working in home community-based services get a wage increase, what that does to recruitment and retention for those working in county-based offices, and also if you have any data to share with us in terms of vacancy rates or recruitment and retention from your perspective at the county level in the care of people with disabilities.
Ms. Solvig.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'll try to answer you as best as I can. I hope I answered it correctly. I do not see this bill, I would not see the exemption as negatively impacting our ability to recruit and retain. Certainly, given this job market count statewide, people are facing additional challenges. Certainly in the metro area, we have no difficulty recruiting and retaining case managers. We have no difficulty recruiting and retaining employees for our DT&H. We've actually had a great deal of longevity in that program, in part probably because we do have higher wages and salaries that we're offering our employees. From a service director perspective, I certainly see with our service providers out in the community, this is absolutely not necessary. We are seeing in many of our group homes and in our home care positions and some of those kinds of things, tremendous difficulty recruiting and retaining staff in those. So from a county's perspective, we certainly support this. And my position today is really about very specifically county exemption for the wage increase piece.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that you are talking about an exemption for that county piece, but we've, you know, for years have heard about the difficulty in recruiting and retaining skilled staff to care for people in their homes, that this is, you know, a hard kind of work. Certainly I've experienced in my tenure some home care work, so, you know, have a window into the challenge of it. And I appreciate that county's perspective on the budget question, not so much on the collective bargaining piece. However, I just want to understand from the ground up, and again, maybe you can't answer this now, but it would be important to me to understand what this exemption would mean in terms of our continued ability to attract a workforce in greater Minnesota to care for people. And so if you can't answer it now, it's fine, but I think it's important for the committee and for the legislature to understand what that impact would be if we issued or if we decided on an exemption.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I do not believe this exemption would have any impact on that ability. That's not who we're talking about here. I absolutely agree with you that folks that are in the community caring with people disabilities, they need to have wage increases. This, our exemption is really specific to county case managers other than the two county-owned facilities, which is the DT&H in Scott County and the ICF, which I believe is in Ramsey County. I believe are the only two direct care programs that the exemption would apply to. Otherwise, that exemption is only for county case managers. It is not at all specific to people on the ground doing the work with people with disabilities in their home or in group homes or those kinds of things.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and I think, you know, more to come on that. Right?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure this is for the county testifier. It's really to another piece of the bill. I don't know if Representative Baker can answer this, or maybe let me just put the question out there, and we'll just see who could answer it. So, as I'm looking through the bill, I mean, first of all, let me just say that although, you know, all of us probably really, really recognize the problem here. And I sure hope we can do something about it this year. And this is really a crisis. And I'm hearing a lot about it from my constituents. I know all of us are. We should have done this in the last session. You know, shame on us if we can't do something about this time. But as I'm looking through the bill, I'm also looking on Subdivision 9, 4.20 talks about managed care and county-based purchasing and adjusting those rates. And it says a managed care plan or county-based purchasing plan receiving payments for these services must include the increase in their payments to providers. So here we are again. Thank you for coming up, Mr. Goodnow. So once again, are we able to ensure that any rate increase that we might pass here would actually go through the managed care plans? And maybe you could just clarify, too, who would they be that would be paid by managed care plans under our, I assume, under our Medicaid program?
Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, happy Valentine's Day to everybody. That is an area, Representative Liebling, you pointed out an issue that because of the new federal rule changes with regard to managed care plans under medical assistance, I'm Kevin Goodnow. I'm representing the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, and also the Best Life Alliance, the organization, the coalition that's behind and promoting the bill, also known as the Friend of the Best Life Alliance. The issue on 4.20 is a matter of, we need to figure that out. Right now, under current law and the way this is written, we will not be able to require the health plans to pass this on. It is an issue that has been flagged by the Department of Human Services with us, that we know we need to do greater work on to see if there is a way that we can make sure that it gets passed on. That's the simple answer to it at this point. With regard to who this would apply to, we do have a list of those that are included in the application. So the intent is that the rate increase and the required salary increase, wage increase, would be related to direct care workers. And I would need to, with all due respect, correct Ms. Elvig, who made a comment about county caseworkers. And I would say it's very clear in this legislation that they are not included in the wage increase. And to the extent, because we do refer directly to direct care workers, we have changed the reference to the waivered services to be very specific to those that are where the rates are determined under the new rate-setting methodology, which would exclude county caseworkers. And then also we exempt county workers except for those that are providing direct care services. So with regard to the request from the counties, it really only impacts, it, from what I'm aware, two facilities or two service organizations. One is the Lake Owosso in Ramsey County. It's an ICF. And then also Scott County has a DTNH facility. The reason that they're able to pay the higher rates is that I believe both of those have, the county heavily subsidized both.
Yeah.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Sharon. Thank you for that, Mr. Goodnow. And the other question I have, that when Ms. Solvig was talking, I'm a little confused because the counties, the bill, as I understand it, the bill is funding the increases, right? And so when the county is saying, even if it, and I'm glad you clarified that because I was looking at the language and wondering that myself, but so this is not an unfunded mandate on counties, right? It's not an unfunded mandate on anybody as it's written. It's funding and saying, here's the funding, pass it through to the workers. Am I correct about that?
Mr. Goodnow.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, it is funded. So it would be a pass-through that we would, you know, just like any of the other providers that would be providing the same services who are not county-owned or run, that they're required to pass on those rate increases to their employees as well. And it is a funded quote mandate, if you wish.
Right. And Mr.
Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of course, counties, because they have access to property tax dollars, you know, for good or for ill, they can make a decision right now to pay more to people who are working for them. Am I right? So this doesn't interfere with that. And I think that what she was saying is that they're already doing that, and they don't want to have to increase certain wages.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I believe your characterization is correct.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Goodnow while he's up there? Seeing none. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Happy Valentine's Day. My name is Sarah Leverins. I'm an attorney and a lobbyist for Absentee Council 65. We represent nonprofit organization employees and public employees in Greater Minnesota. And those of you who may know me know that I never pass up a chance to talk about the horribly low wages that we pay direct care workers for home and community-based services. I have two pieces I'd like to share with you briefly. One is that when you guys did the 5% and 5%, I believe in 14, we had people come down and testify. And one of the people who testified was a woman who worked 5 days a week for the Developmental Achievement Center and an additional Saturday, every Saturday, for another similar organization. And her husband, as is common in some areas of greater Minnesota, was a seasonal employee. So for a good chunk of the year, he wasn't working. And so that meant that they didn't have enough money always to feed everybody. So what they did was they fed the children first. And they, the parents, our direct care worker who worked 48 hours a week, only ate dinner if there was anything left over after the children ate. And she said to that Senate committee, it's really depressing to work 6 days a week and not be able to eat. And I will tell you, although they got some raises as a result of the increase in the minimum wage, those wages are still pretty terrible. She, the woman I'm talking about works for the Wadena County Developmental Achievement Center. Those folks, most of the direct care people, make $9.70 an hour. A 4% raise on that is 39 cents an hour. Annually, that's $811. You know, obviously, we would be very grateful to the legislature for a 4 and 4. But if you think 4 and 4 is going to solve the staffing shortage crisis in home and community-based services, you know, it's not. $811 for a whole year, $67 a month pre-tax. You know, that is simply not going to do it. And if we're going to solve that 9,000 job opening problem, which more than 10%, we're going to need to make more of an investment in those direct care workers. Because if you can't eat, it's not a job that you want to keep. You're going to be looking for something else. Representative Hamilton, who isn't here today, he will tell you that, or at least did in a previous committee hearing, that farms where he worked hired people starting at $13 an hour. Well, I can help with cows or chickens or whatever the heck he has and make $13 an hour and be able to afford to eat. Or I can make $9.70 an hour taking care of disabled and elderly people and not be able to eat. There's no magic to why they we have the $9,000 job openings. I'd go work with the pigs, too. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony today. Are there any questions for the testifier briefly? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel. I'm a legislative representative for AFSCME Council 5. We represent the employees, direct care workers, at two county-operated facilities. So they are county employees. That's Lake Owosso. It's a 64-bed facility for folks with developmental disabilities. And then we've also got the Scott County DT&H. So I just want to, Mr. Goodnow said most of what I was going to say, so thank you for clarifying that. I just wanted to bring up a couple of additional points. One is that when the legislature had to unfortunately cut the rates here, our folks at the Scott County DT&H went back and renegotiated and took less than what they were going to get in their contract. So it kind of goes both ways. If you're expecting us to be excluded here, then our contract should be my point being, we did our end when you guys cut the rates, and so we should still be allowed to benefit from the rate increase. And the other thing I'd like to clarify is that this doesn't guarantee a full pass-through of the rate. It's not like we're going to get all 4% or 9% on top of our contract. It just allows us to have a conversation with the county and have our input. So if there is an issue in the workplace, like we wanted additional training, this would allow that conversation. So it's not like we're going to be seeing a 9% increase for these folks. That's just a misrepresentation. Thank you.
All right. Other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Any final questions for the bill author? Seeing none, Representative Baker, final word.
Mr. Chair and members, really important bill. Please support this bill. Thank you so much.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 873 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 873 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. The final bill up this morning, members, is House File 814. And I will pass the gavel over to Vice Chair Greenhagen and make my way to the testifying table. And apparently narrate everything I did.
Can you do that?
The bill we have for consideration is House File 814. Chair Schumacher moves the bill to be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Chair Schumacher, I believe you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill into the form that I'd like to present it.
Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment passes. We have the bill before us, Chair Schumacher, to the bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 814 is an effort to get things kind of revised into the disability waiver rate system settings. So a few years ago, back in 2014, we had to comply with federal regulations that changed from the county-by-county rate setting system that we had to move into a statewide rate setting system. And within that, we had 5 years' worth of banding to try and get the rate set to the way that we needed to make things work without having external pressures our pressures on the systems overall. That would be drastic, 10% swings one way or the other. And so we've had this banding in place, and we also had the 5 years to find what kind of technical changes needed to be made to the process overall, what kind of changes needed to be made in order to make the new DWRS system work for us. And that's what we're at today. We were hoping that this would come in the first 2 years. We're now in year four of the banding, with one more year possibly with banding, and then one final year after that potentially there. And so we're trying to make changes to the system that can bring some sustainable usage to it as we move forward and can continue to use this into the future. With that, I will ask that my testifier, Mr. Goodnow, present some of the details on the bill for you, and we'll go from there.
Mr. Goodnow, you want to introduce yourself and address the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, also known as MOR, and also with that group on behalf of the DWRS Coalition, which is a broader coalition of providers and advocates that are impacted by this new rate-setting methodology. Appreciate Representative Schumacher's willingness to move forward with House File 814. It does reflect an ongoing work to try to correct the flaws in the and address the concerns that have been identified with the new rate setting methodology that impacts providers of services that fall under the waivered services that are out there. So it includes providers of services for residential residential services and day services and other unit-based services that are out there. The bill itself is 12 sections long. It's 24 pages long. The bulk of it, actually every section of it, relates to the formula and how the rates themselves are calculated, with the exception of Section 11, which is on page 22, line 27, which talks about a prompt service agreement authorization. So every time there's a change in the rates and the service that an individual receives, the county or the lead agency needs to provide another service agreement, and there needs to be an authorization. Without that service agreement, providers aren't able to bill for the services or technically are not able to. And so what that provision does within the bill, it really focuses on and says that there needs to be a prompt issuance of the service agreement authorization so there's not a delay and being able to bill for the services under that. The other 11 sections relate to various aspects of the formula that's used in order to calculate the wages for the different broad service categories. Those service categories are residential services, day services, and different two variations of unit-based services. The bill itself affects and changes issues related to how the base wage index is calculated in here, what the various component values are related to the formulas, and then also the inflationary adjustment in moving that from 5 years to 2 years, largely related to the finance of the bill. I wanted to highlight a couple changes that are more related, I believe, to the policy aspects, and then I'd be happy to stand for any questions. One is related to the issue with regard to licensing fees, and that's found in sections 1, 2, 8, and 9. It's a combination of those four sections, which basically is that we establish that licensing fees calculation of any costs related to those would be built into the rates, so it's passed on, that the provider will be able to get reimbursed for any increase in licensing fees. The benefit of that is you're able to draw down a Medicaid match if it's built into the formula and through the Medicaid system. The other two items I'd like to highlight are related to the exceptions. That's found in Section 10, starting at line page 22, page 4. One of the concerns we have with the rate-setting methodology is that the new rate system, as it's going fully when the banding comes off, when we're going from the historical rate to the new rate, there are a number of providers and clients and recipients that will see a large, potentially see a large reduction in the rates that they'll be reimbursed for those services, which could result in access issues for these type of services potentially throughout Minnesota. So we have a couple protections for the recipient in there. The one is found on page 22, line 4, which just has what I refer to as the 1% phase down to the RMS rate. So when banding comes off, this would continue through the exception process to allow for a gradual movement towards from the old rate to the new rate over a period of time until you get to the new rate in 1% increments over a period of time. I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you quickly. I know we only have 15 minutes. So. The other thing that we have is on page 22, line 13, and it's related to an automatic trigger for the exception process. That relates to if somebody sees their historic rate going from to their RMS rate is greater than a 10% reduction, it would automatically require that the county case manager review the file along with interested stakeholders to make an assessment if those services would still be accessible to that individual in the geographic area. And if the assessment was made that they would not be, but for a higher rate, that would kick in a higher rate through the exception process for that. With that, that's a high overview of what's in the bill, and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Members, any questions? Representative Lieber.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I mean, this has never been easy stuff. Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. I think you might be the only one who totally can explain it, and I hope Representative Schumacher is ready to do that on the floor. I'm sure he will be.
Give me time, Representative Berlin.
Okay, I know. But so am I understanding then that what you're saying is that the banding, the banding, which I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but in other words, we had to, so just to recap this, counties used to decide these rates and negotiate the rates. And then CMS, the feds, came and said, you can't do that. We need statewide rates that are uniform, or that at least have criteria that are uniform. So the banding meant that there could only be, was to make this change gradually so that we didn't lose services and that people had a chance to adjust. And so from what I'm understanding, from what you just explained, that wasn't good enough. We need to keep going on that because even after the 4 years or the 5 years, we're still worried that the swings will be too great. I guess, is am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Goodnow?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, that's correct. And I apologize to the committee members. I had, you got the five-minute version of my half-hour version of explaining this bill. But what Representative Liebling said, what you said is absolutely correct about the banding. There is a concern. When we implemented the bill and when it was passed, we put in safeguards to allow for that transition through the banding period, which allowed for a gradual decrease in the rates or increase in the rates to the new rate over a period of time. And right now, it was initially passed with 5 years of banding, and we've added a sixth year that's pending in front of the federal government. The idea was that the first 2 years of after implementation, we would gather data, come back, make needed corrections to the system in order to ensure that we have services going forward, and then allow 3 years of time in order to make business decisions to change and change the operations accordingly. We're in year four. We didn't collect the data as quickly as we thought we could, and so we're actually in a two-year delay on that. And what the data is showing, at least in the day services, the groups that I represent, that especially in the metropolitan area, a lot of the providers and a lot of the recipients are going to be seeing double-digit decreases, at least from the data that we have. And so there's a concern about the ability to continue to access those services. I would note that the two provisions that we have in the bill related to this, it's not a continuation of banding. It actually has a narrower scope than that and applies to a narrower group of recipients. So it is refined somewhat from what the original banding proposal was, but essentially what you said is correct.
Okay.
Representative Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay. So, Mr. Goodnow, I guess the only other thing, you know, when we're talking about this, what will happen if some of these rates drop precipitously and stuff, how is this related to what Congress is talking about doing in terms of block granting Medicaid and potentially, I mean, none of us knows how much of a reduction that would be for the state, but we're talking here about Medicaid services, correct? And you're worried about, you know, rates dropping 10% or something and suddenly everyone loses access to services from that provider because they can't function with 10% less? Is this on the chopping block with that Medicaid block grant idea?
Mr. Goodnow, can you predict what the federal government
Mr. will Chairman, do? Representative Weibling, as well as anybody else can, I guess, Mr. Chairman. This is the potential of a Medicaid block grant is actually the least of our worries at this point. We have new standards coming down from CMS related to the home and community-based standards rule. We have the 245D licensure changes that have put pressures on us, and also the Olmstead plan that's come out of the Jensen decision. What we really need with this rate system is to make sure that just the very basic core of how we receive how we're paid for services, that system is stabilized going forward, and we're trying to identify compartmentalize the problems we have to deal with. I would say on the block grant issue in particular, I think it would have a difficult time with the court decisions related to Olmstead, the ADA law on the federal level, to say that you would be allowed to, as a state, even to pull back from these services. I do think if we don't address this issue in the bill right now, that we potentially do have some Olmstead issues ourselves, notwithstanding anything else that may be happening. So that's my best guess.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final thing. So it sounds like, Mr. Goodnow, what you're kind of saying is that this will be scalable, you know, to use that term that we throw around here, that if the funding is cut, that at least the methodology will be in place. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I believe, first of all, the bill itself, as been presented to you, is kind of a list of all the issues that we feel need to be dealt with. We understand that the bill itself has to be scalable because it's going to be a very expensive bill, and that will be something I know we'll have further conversations about. Once whatever changes are put into place, whenever that's done, certainly you can set the rate methodology in such a way that you can scale back on how much payments are being made, or who can access or what the level of services are. But we always have to have that eye on, are we complying with federal law as it relates to the ADA and the Olmstead decision?
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but...
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And finally, Mr. Goodnow, DHS hasn't come down to comment on this, and maybe you already know. Are they okay with what this is being done in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, we're in continued discussions with DHS about the different aspects of the bill. They had initiatives related to rate setting methodology in the governor's proposal, and we disagree with some of those. They disagree with some of ours. I know that they can't support this bill because it's inconsistent with the governor's budget. But we are working with them to try to figure out how we can make sure that we have a system that's stable going forward and that it meets the needs of people with disabilities throughout Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. We're up against the clock, members, but are there any other questions from members? Seeing none, anybody else want to give a very brief testimony regarding the bill? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jim Clapper. First and foremost, I'm a parent of a young man with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I'm also a co-leader of a grassroots advocacy organization called Minnesota Families and Advocates Coalition, IMFAC. I'm also grateful to be a member of the Disability Waiver Rate System Advisory Council organized by the Disability Service Division of Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My son, Bob, is 30 years old and is happily being served at Merrick, Inc., which is a day training and rehabilitation program in Badness Heights. He is flourishing in their employment program. He likes the work, the safety, and the security of this setting, and the association of his peers and staff. In my work with IMFAC over the last year plus, I've had the opportunity to speak with several hundred parents, guardians, and family members in meetings around the state about DWRS. Many have obtained projected rate changes for their loved ones for the new rate management system within DWRS. Almost all of them are reporting 2019 rate reductions anywhere from 10 to 41%. In the case of my son Bob, his rate reduction will be 21%. I've also had the opportunity in these meetings to hear what service providers will experience as they roll up the individual rate impacts. Many are reporting net reductions of 15 to 35% upon full implementation of DWRS. These reductions are very significant and could result in a high rate of closures, which will remove services and valuable choices for this community of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. HF 814 would resolve the serious jeopardy day and employment services programs are facing and will keep center-based employment in Minnesota open as a viable choice and a valuable service. I'm very proud of our history in Minnesota of serving individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Let's keep Minnesota in a leadership position here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clapper. We're up against the clock, members, so I'm not going to ask for questions right now. And I would ask that Mr. Preeby keep his testimony to 1 minute if possible.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and address the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Preeby. I'm the CEO of Homeward Bound. Homeward Bound is a nonprofit in existence since 1973. We work with the most vulnerable individuals, Minnesotans, that you could possibly imagine, folks with severe to profound physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, and healthcare conditions. I'd like to speak in favor of House File 814. The DWRS system is a very complex system for the disability community. We know we have been tweaking it for years. I've been involved in this process for years, and we probably will have to continue to tweak it for years after that. There are three pieces in 814 especially that I'd like to mention that help Homeward Bound in its mission of delivering services to people with severe and profound disabilities. The first is it ties the supervisory wage of direct support professionals to the Bureau of Labor Statistics qualifications and raises the wage. It's extremely important for us to be able to hire people of high quality to supervise, train, evaluate, and oversee the performance of direct service staff, especially when they work with people with very complex service protocols that involve lots of intellectual activity and high labor activity. Second, it ties the nursing wages for both LPNs and RNs to the BLS standards. We do have a workforce crisis for nursing. And third, it increases the procedural steps and protections for providers when it comes to authorizing service agreements, which allow providers to get paid.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Preeby. Any very brief questions for the testifiers, members? Seeing none, Chair Schumacher, would you like to...
I will renew my motion that House File 814 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay, with that, members, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, members. With that, members, we are adjourned.